Ready for a career in behavioral health? Earn your online degree at Herzing University. Choose from health and human services, psychology, or social work programs. Gain the skills to work, coordinate, and manage nonprofits. Secure a bachelor's in psychology to study mental health or advance your social work career through our online Masters of Social Work. Let us help you become a social change agent. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Text HEALTH to 85109. That's HEALTH to 85109. Or visit herzing.edu.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those sentiments originally uttered by Gramsci, although refined in language by Zizek, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast, sponsored by The Nation magazine and available wherever you can listen to podcasts. This week, we're going to take on the Democrats. Now, usually on this podcast, we spend a lot of time talking about the right, who are, I think, the preeminent monsters of this era. But I think that we'd be amiss in not knowing that Democrats have their own problems. And I think we're starting to see some of that with two recent developments. One is the inexplicable, bizarre, self-defeating decision of New York Governor Kathy Hochul to push for a judge who is very unpopular with her own party. And that led to a kind of defeat in a Senate, in a committee in New York State. But that story is still persisting because it looks like, Captain Ahab, Kathy Hochul does not know the meaning of the word no. And the other story is they just announced, it looks like Joe Biden is tapping a gentleman by the name of Jeffrey Zients to be his chief of staff, which is a very important White House position. It's the kind of, person who really is the gatekeeper and the agenda setter in the White House, replacing Ron Klein. And there's a lot of worries that Zients represents maybe the more centrist and corporate wing of the party. He himself has basically, when he's not in government service, is a kind of CEO of business enterprises that are known for sort of predatory practices. And like the Hochul thing, the Zients appointment, maybe speaks of where the Democratic Party is or where the leaders of the Democratic Party are, which might not be actually where the party itself is. And I think that could lead to problems. To talk about all this, I'm very happy to have on for the first time as a guest, Alex Salmon, political writer for Slate, who's written about some of this. So let's start with the New York State. What's your sort of sense of what exactly the governor is doing?
Well, I think at this point, she's basically courting a constitutional crisis, which is a very extreme outcome of a series of kind of inexplicable or semi-explicable blunders. I think, the way that this starts is she actually, gets this incredible windfall, which is that Janet DeFiore, who is the highest ranking member on the Court of Appeals in New York, which is the highest court in New York State, decides to announce that she's going to step down before her term is over. I think that was in August of last year. And that was a real surprise because she was a very close ally of Andrew Cuomo. She was someone who had basically led this conservative 4-3 block on the court in New York. Cuomo had appointed all four of those conservative judges. But she announced she was going to step down. I mean, she was in the middle of an ethics investigation, which maybe helped expedite things. But her announcement was a huge windfall for Hochul, because not only did it mean that Hochul was going to be able to basically reconstitute the court to create a 4-3 liberal majority if she wanted to, just a handful of days into office, but it also gave her a chance to kind of like turn the page on the Cuomo era and kind of cast out some of the bad feelings about the horrible campaign that she ran, where she won by only 5 points, despite running in a state where Democratic voters outnumber Republicans 2-1. So it comes from like a moment of kind of like surprise, optimism, and opportunity about what she could do as governor of New York. So then she runs this campaign. She does terribly. There's a lot of grumbling within the party, and then she produces her nominee for this position, which is Hector LaSalle, and things start to unravel.
No, I mean, so she has an opportunity to change the courts, and I mean, to give sort of listeners who aren't in New York State a sense of it, this is like, you know, imagine this sort of a moment where Justice Scalia died, and imagine if Obama had had a Democratic Senate majority. And so Scalia dies, you can change a 5-4 Republican court into a 5-4 Democratic court. And then Obama decides to nominate Brett Kavanaugh. I think people, if that had happened, this alternative scenario, I think people would have been A, puzzled, and B, angry. Especially Democrats would have been very angry. And so, I don't think it's too far to say, because Hector LaSalle is a conservative, and he did anger a lot of Democrats. I mean, it's often presented in the press that the progressives are angry, but it's very interesting that I think a wide swath of very mainstream Democrats aren't happy with him. And maybe you want to explain why, like, this is a very bizarre swing justice to put on a Democratic governor to put on, especially when she doesn't have to, because she has a majority in the legislature.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And in a way, it's almost worse than the Kavanaugh analogy, because we're on the other side now of that, and we've seen what the court can do with this incredible conservative majority, and Hochul did this anyways. So it's almost even more confusing. It's a really great point. And what happens is, right, so she makes this announcement, and it's, you know, no surprise, I think there's a combination of like ideology and ineptitude here, where, you know, it's not a surprise that Hochul wants kind of a right wing or a rightish or a conservative choice. But she names LaSalle as her pick. No surprise that progressives in New York State come out against him. That wasn't, you know, that's kind of a no brainer. The Democratic Socialist for America candidates who are in the Senate were the first three to say, we won't support LaSalle. There's no way. That makes a lot of sense. What was really interesting was that almost immediately thereafter, the big labor unions came out and said, absolutely no way. We can't support a candidate like this. And then the women's groups, the very mainstream women's groups and pro-choice groups came out and said, there's no way we can support a candidate like this. And that actually is a really interesting development, because during the Cuomo years in New York, the sort of like progressive left and the DSA were often kind of at odds with the big mainstream liberal groups. And he played them off each other to some degree. And that was why the left was, you know, was kind of weaker or fragmented in New York in a way that was, I think, sometimes confusing for outsiders. But in this situation, Hochul managed to galvanize both the left-wing activist groups and the mainstream liberal groups all in on this being, you know, getting them all on the same page to fight this candidate and this nominee, which is really shocking. I mean, it was really like big moderate to conservative labor groups saying no chance, and we're going to basically fight alongside the DSA against this candidate. And that really hasn't happened before.
Yeah, no. I mean, it is in politics, you want to, like, you know, unite your side and divide the enemy. And she, Hochul, managed to do the opposite of uniting her enemies and perhaps also dividing her team. So, I mean, the basic there are many objections to Hector LaSalle, but I mean, I it does seem like from his record, there are court cases where you can kind of point to him being, you know, like not friendly to the pro-choice side, not friendly to unions. And there's also this, I mean, I think very striking case on striking down a juror or allowing a juror to be struck down for having darker skin, and arguing that having darker skin is not a protected category, a decision that was, like, you know, overturned. It's fair to say that there was like a wide Democratic opposition, as you suggest. But facing that, she doesn't withdraw. She sort of, like, you know, puts all her political capital in. And do you want to talk about that? Like, just how much she's investing in this fight.
Right. Yeah, which is really fascinating. So coming off that election where she won by 5 points, she did not have a lot of political capital built up. So there were people all over New York and, you know, Albany and downstate in the city who felt like Hochul at the top of the ticket really dragged them down. Like, you know, people in the state Senate, in the legislature, even, you know, all, you know, even in Congress, who would have said, like, you know, it was really, really hard to win with Hochul at the top of that ticket because she did nothing for us. She didn't have a campaign. She didn't turn people out. And so already there was a feeling like, you know, we don't owe Hochul anything because, you know, we, you know, if anything, we helped her. And then so she makes this pick and then goes, you know, starts cashing in whatever political capital she has, whatever chips she has left. And they aren't many. But she's, you know, trying to do something of the Andrew Cuomo impersonation where she's saying she's going to remember who had her back on this. And she's making these kind of intimidating calls and threatening people to, you know, to get behind her. And to be fair, like the Senate, the Democratic Senate caucus in New York doesn't want this fight. Like at no point were they like, okay, you know, we're going to show Hochul how weak she is and we're going to dash this campaign or this nominee just to prove it. They kept saying, you know, please pick somebody else. Like just set this nominee aside. And there are so many qualified candidates that they would love to support, but she kept going and refused to set it aside. And, you know, started ginning up support from confusing corners of the political arena in New York. And a lot of it was, as we saw in the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing, a lot of it was GOP support. And still is unable to get it through. And so, you know, when this committee meets and they vote down LaSalle, you know, Hochul still has said that she won't set aside this nominee. She's now threatening to sue. So, you know, it's at no point willing to just set this aside, pick somebody else, and has pushed it to just an extreme.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned Andrew Cuomo, the former governor, because I mean, I think one way to make sense of Hochul's behavior is, as you said, she's doing a kind of poor Andrew Cuomo imitation. But I mean, he had a strategy which, even though he, you know, left in disgrace, did work for him for a while, of like, you know, being the tough guy, sort of forcing the left to, like, you know, swallow the medicine and like just like bend the knee and sort of divide and conquer, of setting different forces in the Democratic Party against each other. So my analysis is that she's like that's the model that she knows, and she's not aware that A, she doesn't have the political capital to pull that off, but B, I mean, it might not even like work anymore. Like, it does seem like the sort of Democratic Party, even the sort of more mainstream members who aren't like socialist, like they're a bit sick and tired of this kind of, you know, having a Democratic governor who's a kind of like a basically a moderate Republican.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think there are like two things to this, one of which is part of what's so vexing and confusing, I think, about this is that even someone like Hakeem Jeffries, who is, you know, very much a manufacturer of the New York political world, of the Cuomo machine in some ways. He was a former Cuomo ally. He was someone who was on record criticizing Janet DeFiore, the outgoing chief judge of the appeals court. He was incredibly critical of her. He, you know, he cheered when she left. He was, you know, there was kind of this widespread understanding that the court had gone too far right, that what Cuomo had done to the court was an atrocity and they had to reverse course. And so Jeffries, who doesn't tend to sort of like do these sorts of things with conservatives, was very, very critical of DeFiore. But then, of course, when Hochul came calling looking for some support for LaSalle, who, according to everybody else in Democratic politics, was the same as DeFiore in a lot of ways. And LaSalle himself put DeFiore on his application as his number one recommender for the job. Then, of course, Hakeem Jeffries was out there supporting Hochul and supporting LaSalle. That is one of the more confusing things. We can talk about that more if you want to. But I think the other thing that's really worth pointing out is that for some reason, some of these New York Democrats have a really hard time with the sort of object permanence of the political climate, where there are all these shocks to the New York Democratic machine that prove that it's not very strong anymore. And the first was Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez winning her election in 2018. That should have totally recalibrated things. and proven to New York Democrats beyond a doubt that the Cuomo machine is not as strong as it once was. And then these things keep happening over and over and over again for the last 5 years. And still they're surprised that the machine is not as strong as it once was. And you can't just pick someone regardless of where they fall on the political spectrum and force them through against the will of the Senate and the legislature and the activist groups and the unions and everybody else. It just doesn't work like that anymore. And it's so funny to see, Hochul and her advisors are obviously living in this pre-2018 world still, and they can't quite accept the fact that it's not the way that it was.
Yeah, no, that's a really good analysis. And I think sort of it fits in with my meta analysis of what happened in the midterms, where I think you saw in across America, in places where the sort of traditional Democratic machine had adapted and was willing to work with grassroots activists and the new wave of activist energy, the Democrats did very well. I think Pennsylvania is a good example. Michigan is a good example. And New York kind of stands apart from that because it has this history of a sort of sclerotic machine.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
That is actively hostile to any grassroots activism. And I think that really hurt the Democrats. It probably cost them the National Party, control of the House. If one takeaway from this whole fiasco, which is an ongoing fiasco, is that it seems the New York machine is sort of incapable of learning, and it still, as you say, has this pre-2018 mindset. But that's probably a good segue to the other aspect I wanted to talk about, because I think on the national level we see the same thing with Biden and the chief of staff. The outgoing chief of staff, Ron Klain, not somebody from the left of the party, but notable, I think, for making significant outreaches to the more progressive Democrats and trying to, run a unified party and trying to integrate the different factions of the party, including progressives. I think he deserves a lot of the credit for the successes that Biden has had in the last 2 years. So now that he's out, it seems the new fellow that's coming in does not have that. There's someone coming, from a sort of very corporate background, and I don't think has ever really shown an ability to deal with the left. But your thoughts on that?
Yeah, definitely. It's an interesting, right? It's why aren't these lessons sticking? It's picking Ron Klain. Klain did a great job of outreach to these progressive groups in DC, to the grassroots. In a weird way, it's just given how well things went in the midterms, you would say that this formula seems to be working, right? That if you can figure out a way to not antagonize the progressive groups to the utmost degree, keep them in the fold, address some of their concerns, you do kind of have a winning coalition. And then, when Klain steps down and they pick Jeffrey Zients, I very much of that old model. I mean, both the private sector and the public sector work, I think, is littered with line items that would make you really, really concerned about what he'll do in that position. Obviously, chief of staff is incredibly important, but also it's another sort of, you just have to ask the question, is this an own goal for Biden and the Biden administration? I mean, is the sort of line that's going around DC right now as well, it's okay that Zients has this corporate background. He came, he's a private equity creature who made a ton of money on Wall Street, invested in some firms that were caught the attention of the DOJ for defrauding Medicare. There's a lot of stuff in there that would raise an eyebrow. But the Biden administration has spent the last 2 years slamming private equity. I mean, they've really done that more than almost anybody else, they've said that like these are the firms that are making the American dream impossible, that have, you know, have made upward mobility so difficult. And we're gonna, you know, we're gonna battle them on tax policy, on monopoly policy. And then here you have this guy who came up through that, who made all his money doing that, who was on the board of directors of Facebook. And at the same time, you know, we're saying that the Biden administration is going to pursue this antitrust bill against big tech. It's just really hard to reconcile. And it does feel like, again, a huge step back in that sense towards a mode of operation that is very much reminiscent of the Obama years. And that's obviously where Zients really, you know, made his reputation in D.C. was during the Obama years as well.
Yeah, no, he does seem like a throwback. And I'm glad you mentioned sort of like Biden, because I mean, I think the Zients being elevated to chief of staff, like, is in contrast with who Biden has tried to be in the last 2 years. I mean, I think one of Biden's successes has been to try to revive a type of labor liberalism and to make, there have been obvious failures along the way, like the railway strike. But in general, I mean, he's had an administration that's unusually friendly towards labor, is unusually critical of private equity. And politically, I mean, the Democrats reap a lot of benefits. I mean, like, you know, Obama won re-election by painting Mitt Romney as this sort of, you know, Bain capital. And, you know, when Bain comes to town, and now, you know, they have as chief of staff, someone, you know, who's of that world. It seems to like undercut a lot of their messages. But I mean, yeah, well, as you said, there's a kind of line going around, well, it doesn't really matter. Like, it's not, you know, it's just, he's just a businessman. Do you want to talk about, I mean, I think there's been some very powerful critiques, especially coming out of Revolving Door Project, you know, about his background and but why, you know, one would not want someone like this in government. Do you want to talk about, you know, like why there's this concern?
Yeah, definitely. Right. I was going back and reading some old clips in the Wall Street Journal from 10 years ago when Zients was working at the Office of Management and Budget for Obama. And the quotes that like corporate CEOs were giving the journal about Zients was that like he was this incredible ambassador for the business community, that like a number of them thought that he was a Republican based on how they interacted with him. And these are verbatim quotes. You know, to bring someone in like that into the White House now, when, as you said, there's been this attempt to sort of re-envision this labor liberalism tradition. And certainly there's been a huge turn away from Wall Street. I mean, that's just the embrace of Wall Street under the Obama administration is just not there under Biden. The line that like, oh, it doesn't matter because they're not going to pass a lot of legislation. It's more about implementation now. But I mean, I would argue that like the implementation is incredibly important, like whether or not these new tax policies are actually implemented in a way that gets these corporations to pay 15%. I think that's pretty important. I don't know why someone who was like the goodwill ambassador to the business community is the person who's going to turn the screws on that and make sure it's tight and in place. And you can just kind of go down the list and you know, these monopoly policies that like the FTC is pursuing. How can the FTC act in one way, and then you have someone who has, you know, benefited so inordinately from monopolistic practice, then be doing the White House side of things? It's really hard to even sort of see how that implementation strategy would work. And so I think this line that it doesn't really matter, or that like, you know, maybe we need to, it's a good sign that they're going to team up with the business community to fight against Republicans. I really struggle to see that. And I especially struggle to see it because Zients really cut his teeth doing fiscal cliff negotiations in 2013, and they were a catastrophe. I mean, he did everything wrong in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that's that whole history is worth going into. There's two things I want to hit on. Implementation. One is that he actually has a track record inside government in terms of like overseeing COVID under Biden and other activities under Obama. And as you mentioned, the fiscal cliff stuff is very concerning, precisely because we know the Republicans are going to use the debt ceiling. They're going to try to like, you know, force Biden to do austerity. I think it's worth going over his record. What does his record show? Is he the sort of, you know, wartime fighter that you need in these battles?
Right. And if you read like the DC press right now, it's all anonymously sourced quotes about how he's like this logistics warrior and like this incredible maven of project management and right, if you look at the track record, I don't know if you see that. I mean, the thing that he did under Biden so far was he right, he's the COVID czar. Spent a year doing that. And some would say, you know, he did a good job because the initial vaccine rollout was fairly successful. But he also, you know, there was a lot of criticism about that approach that the Biden administration took, and like the fact that they got totally caught flat-footed by both the Delta and the Omicron waves, the fact that there didn't seem to be any strategy on testing until there was, you know, the public outcry about them sending tests in the mail. Short of that, there was really nothing on that front. They didn't secure any money for long-term COVID campaigns or strategy. And then, you know, it just at this point, right, the approach has basically been like, all right, well, it would let it rip, and that's that.
Yeah, I mean, there's an argument to be made. I think Eric Levitz sort of made it that just, you know, given the American political system, and the way in which COVID has become polarized, maybe no one could have done a good job. But I have to say, like, the United States, you know, had a very bad reputation under Trump, and it continues under Biden. I mean, like, if you look on an international scale, like the American performance on COVID remains dismal, and I just don't think, you know, like it almost seems like falling upwards, that you have someone who is like, you know, maintained one of the world's, the worst responses of a major industrial country to COVID, is now going to have like one of the most powerful positions in Washington. It's like, even if you say like no one could have done a good job, it's just like, well, maybe, but you know, he's the one that did that job.
Right. And he gets the promotion at the end of it. Or I and I'm trying to be charitable here, but I you know, it's right. There are 700,000 people have died from COVID since Biden took over or more. I mean, that's, you know, the reality is grim, and maybe it's a horrible job, but at the same time, it's, you know, to do a horrible job at a horrible job doesn't mean much, and certainly doesn't you know, it doesn't make the case why that person should be then elevated to, you know, one of the most powerful positions in Washington. And yeah, I mean, you go back through the track record further, the fiscal cliff negotiations. I mean, I think those were one of the lowest points in the Obama administration generally. I think even Obama people now would say like that wasn't great. Like we really had a super strong hand, played it terribly, ended up, you know, this is obviously there's a lot happening, but the, you know, they ended up giving away tax increases on the very rich for basically nothing. There were all these austerity measures put in place. There was no reason any of that had to happen. I think that like the line we're getting now on that is that like, well, we did it wrong that time, but now we've learned and now we're going to do it right. And there are a lot of people who are in the Biden administration who came from the Obama administration who said that on a bunch of stuff. They've been like, well, we may have got it wrong in the past, but now we're going to do it right. And I hope that's true. I just don't feel like that's a super compelling line for why someone needs to be promoted into a incredibly influential and powerful position. And you know, we'll see what the resolve looks like. I mean, I don't know when the chips are really down, if that's gonna ha it's gonna happen.
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah, one doesn't necessarily want to give absolute predictions, and like to say, on the side of those former Obama spokesmen or these current Biden spokes people, I mean, I think it is the case that like Biden at least has learned stuff. He hasn't tried to do as much bipartisan outreach, or at least bipartisan surrender, in the way that the Obama did. I mean, Biden has actually gotten some bipartisan measures, but I think he's much less inclined to like sort of, give up stuff for nothing. So, I mean, like maybe if Biden is in charge, I think the caution that we're trying to introduce here is should also be borne in mind. Like, this is someone who has, at least in governments, a sort of track record of failure. In the business world, he has a track record of success, but that success is through sort of predatory corporations that have basically, defrauded the government. I mean, this is not a hyperbolic comment. The companies that he's run have been repeatedly fined for defrauding the government, and that seems to be the business model of a lot of these firms taking advantage of Medicare. Like, try to see what you can get away with in terms of billing, and then the fines are kind of like a little tax that you have to pay at the end. So I none of that, I mean, to me is reassuring. I don't know. Like, is there any other sort of consolation you can offer aside from what I just said?
I'm hard pressed to think of one. I mean, I looked through the short list. There was a short list that was published in the Times, I think, I don't know, Saturday or Sunday. And there were no names on that list that made me feel especially confident. So I at least, you know, if we're going off of what who else was up there, it's not like we came away with someone who was far worse than anybody else who was at the finish line, which is maybe the closest to a silver lining that I can come up with. I mean, I think that yeah, I don't know. I just think there was a real lack of imagination in this pick, and I think a lack of sort of like understanding of where we're at politically. And you know, the list, it was like, you know, Steve Ricchetti, Anita Dunn, Susan Rice, any of those people would have been you know, a nightmare for any progressive. And you know, maybe the best thing you can say is that like Biden kind of did run on, to some degree, on like, you know, he did some stuff wrong, but I'm gonna do it right this time. And he has kind of done that. He has kind of changed. Does that mean his inner circle has also receptive to that line of thinking? I hope so. I don't know. I hope so.
No, I mean, that's a good to sort of end on. I mean, maybe it sort of speaks to the sort of, I think we're sort of in intermediate stage or interregnum, where, like to some degree, the Democrats have learned that they have to change, but it's still the same old people that are kind of at the very top levels of the party, and a lot of their habits can lead them astray. I think we saw that in New York State, and we might be seeing that in Washington as well. So I that might be the kind of note to end on. Is a kind of a mixed record. Are our Democrats learning? A little. They're learning a little. Are they learning enough? I don't know. But on that note, I want to end the podcast, and then thank Alex for being here. It was a very lively and informative discussion.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.